I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Yeah, hi, welcome everyone, and thanks for being here, Kay, and thank you all for being here. And congratulations on Mrs. S, which came out last Thursday.
Yeah.
The book is absolutely wonderful and has rightly received much praise. Just a few more words about you by way of introduction. So you're based in the Isle of Lewis?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. Can you explain where that is? Because I didn't know.
Why or where?
Where?
Oh, right. It's... I was like, well,
Most people probably know. Why do you live there?
Why? Tell me. It's... If you go to the Isle of Skye, I think everyone knows the Isle of Skye, and then take a two-hour ferry, it's there, Outer Hebrides.
The perfect place to write a book. An amazing, very cliché place to write a book. So your poetry has appeared in Poetry Review and Five Dials and was shortlisted for the White Review Poetry Prize in 2021, the same year that you were shortlisted for the White Review Fiction Prize for your short story Eggs. In 2020, you were the runner-up of the Ivan Duritz Prize and the Laura Kinsella Fellowship, and Mrs. S is your debut novel. So the book is absolutely beautiful. I urge everyone to buy a copy tonight if you haven't already read it. It would be really helpful, just in terms of spoilers, to know who has read, had a chance to read the novel already.
Oh.
Okay. Cool. We're like 50-50. We're going to try really hard to avoid spoilers. But one thing I will say is that I was telling you that I quite naively thought that it would be a will they, won't they, where they don't. And you were like...
How could they not? Nah.
Yeah. And that's that. We'll hope that that's the only thing that we give away. And yeah, I fell in love with the book. I thought I would fall in love with Mrs. S because she is quite my type. But I actually fell most in love with the housemistress, which is the kind of friend character in the book who we'll talk about more later, who's a kind of queer friend that the matron meets at the boarding school. And we have disclosed that they do, so there is sex in the book.
Just a bit, yeah.
Just a bit of sex. And we thought we should tell you that because it will help you all buy the book. Although we should issue some kind of health warning about reading it in this heat.
Oh, well, sure, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. But at the same time, it's like a really fantastic beach read because it's quite sexy, you know?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah. But like a highbrow beach.
Yeah, like no fainting. We don't want any fainting.
No, you might faint reading it. I nearly did. And so, yeah, tonight we're going to avoid spoilers. Later we are going to have a conversation about who would play Mrs. S in a film, which will be fun. But before that, we'll just talk through the book and at the end there will be an opportunity for questions. But first of all, you're going to read us an excerpt so anyone who hasn't read it yet gets to hear some.
I am, yeah. Apologies, I still sort of read like a kid at assembly, so it might be a bit of and not a lot of eye contact, but I'm reading a bit from, it's the extracts and Granta, but I suppose this happens, we'll just call it pre-sex now, I guess, like that's the marker. It's just a pre and a post. And Mrs. S and the protagonist are sort of getting closer and closer in a way. Made that sound more mysterious than it is. We come out of the trees and stagger further down. The slope is steeper now. A sound of water increases. She crouches, picks a clover and bites behind its head. She doesn't offer or ask me to do the same. Instead, the flavour is announced, sweet, something like honey. Wonderful, she confirms. Her personalities catch like loose thread on a branch. The old-fashioned headmaster's wife and this person, setting her teeth to a stem's nape, stood tall in her pink shorts. Almost there. Scree is loose under my feet. Water appears. A clear river. Heather makes soft mounds. She whips through the bracken, points to a distant fell and suggests climbing it, not today, but one day. I am hopeful. We drop down onto a track. There is nothing but the rhythm of our shoes on the dusty surface, birdsong, breath, focused in the heat. I want to ask her how she, how they, found this place, but the quiet is too lovely. Familiarity, a new familiarity, this time bodily, little clutches of fabric, the swipe of our thighs. This is it. At first I can't see anything, only slabs of grey stone. She moves towards a copse of only five or six trees, slender silver bark, green leaves. I watch her first, standing an edge, peering down, pleased. It needed to be as good as she remembered. Without waiting for me, she removes her white shirt, each button a piece of my own spine undone. Her swimming costume is an athlete's, black, streamlined. I am surprised by her strength. She adjusts the fit, a finger slid underneath the short straps, then the place where the suit meets her hips. She catches me watching her. I blush. She calls to me. My anxiety has its own heartbeat, desperate for the cool across my sticky face. I wear a sleeveless T-shirt, the binder hidden underneath, underpants too, the T-shirt's hem past my hips, stopping mid-thigh. You'll go in wearing that? Yeah, no costume. I didn't bring one with me. Never thought it would be warm enough to swim. Little did you know. She accepts my lie, my costume balled up in my underwear drawer. I no longer know how to wear it. I reach her at the edge. She has waited for my reaction. Below is a large waterfall, a pool eroded beneath it, bigger than I imagined, enough to spend time swimming to either side, jeweled surface. A fish, brown trout, she explains, is visible deep on the stony bed. It's beautiful. It is. She clambers down and dives. Muscle, water, her back is a swimmer's back. All arch and grace.
Thank you.
So get some trading.
Thank God there's aircon. I related so much to the book because I went to an all-girls school and I'm gay. And there's going to be a lot of gay chat in this talk. And also the class stuff. So essentially this character, the matron, feels kind of constantly surveilled and constantly sort of hypervigilant. Mm-hmm. A different class to the girls at the boarding school and also presents in a masculine way. And I think anyone who's felt sort of different in a space could also maybe relate to that. But mm-hmm. I just wondered if you had been in a similar environment in your life where you perhaps draw. It just felt like you might have been drawing from something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was in the same situation, so an all-girls environment. And even though at the time, I guess I hadn't quite translated my body in the way that the narrator has in the book, I definitely felt like it's more a, it's like a retrospect, feeling in retrospect, isn't it? Like I knew something was different. I knew I was gay, didn't even have a language to express that at the time. So I think, but I wasn't, with the book, I wasn't interested in writing a coming-of-age story in that way. Like, I wanted to have the queerness posited and set in stone from the start, mm-hmm. So that the protagonist is speaking from a place of self-knowledge, but then with potential for that to be extended, I guess, as well. Mm. Yeah.
Where did the sort of seed of the idea come from? Because you told me that you... you quite apologetically told me that you wrote this book in a sort of feverish 4 months during the pandemic.
Yeah, no one likes hearing that.
It's
no
really
one likes
annoying.
That you're productive
subjectively
in the
really annoying if you're a writer.
Definitely annoying.
But was it in your mind for a long time before that?
I know I'm supposed to say that it was, but I think it was more, and it's the quote that haunts me everywhere I go, I wanted to write a horny lesbian novel. Thus goes, I'm forever immortalised saying that about 8,000 times now, but that was the main impulse of writing, it was that, and I thought that it would be this very straightforward, happy ending, beginning, middle and end plot. And of course, when I started writing it, it wasn't, because queer desire is so complicated, so wonderfully complicated in so many ways, but it couldn't be as clear-cut as I imagined. I thought they'd be running off into the sunset together and living happily. Spoiler alert. Oh, do they? I don't know.
Why did you want to write a horny lesbian novel?
Because there's not enough of them.
Right, okay.
I think because I felt like there are so many amazing lesbian novels from across the ages. I think I definitely don't want to be one of those queers that's like, no one did it before I did. But I think in terms of sexuality and expressing sexuality in terms of sex, mm-hmm. it felt like maybe that part of it was lacking a bit in like the mm-hmm. current market. So I feel like I wanted to just throw loads of sex in it was my plan.
Right. So when you think of horny lesbian novels of the past, often there is all the same sort of longing stuff and they titillate, yeah. but they're not kind of... They don't really go there.
No, they don't really go there.
You can swear, I think.
I don't think I can say the F word, can I? Oh, I can. They don't fuck, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was gonna say. Yeah, okay. What are some horny lesbian novels that you come to mind?
Like titillating ones?
Well, Price of Salt is an immediate connection because of the age gap as well.
Price of Salt definitely was in the back of my mind. I think there's lots of books where it feels like there's queer longing that maybe isn't explicit. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm sitting here, I can't think of any of them because I'm so nervous and I'm hyperventilating now.
Well, what feels different about this, having read quite a lot of horny lesbian novels, although maybe not enough, is that I didn't feel that I had read one where the protagonist was more mask presenting or trans mask, and that was kind of what felt new. And that, you know, that trope of the horny lesbian novel or the horny lesbian film of the longing lesbian gaze, that felt different in this because the gaze wasn't just about longing. It was also about, as I said before, surveillance and vigilance, and also, I think, feeling othered through gender nonconformity. And that was what I felt Mrs. S brought to the genre that we haven't had enough of.
Yeah, I think... Like Leslie Feinberg's Butch Booze, obviously, that was in the back of my head as well. And I think that idea of how you want to be seen and how that becomes involved in the language of sex and in sex itself as well was so important. I didn't know that would be important to begin with, but of course it became important when writing sex, which is something that I really wanted to do well. Obviously, you're going to write a horny book, you have to make sure you don't mess up that part of it. But that idea of interiority... exteriority, like how those two things interact, especially when you're being intimate with someone. Now I sound like my mum. But you know what I mean, that idea of this strange mirror that gets held up in those circumstances as well, I think. That mimicry that happens between two people too.
Yeah.
So you end up seeing yourself. I think sex can also be very exposing in that way, where you see something new, there's potential in that act as well. So that felt important too.
Yeah. And it is a queer romance, but it's also... sort of fits into the boarding school novel genre. Am I describing that right? I don't really...
No. Engineer, I just thought of another titillating lesbian novel.
Yeah.
Sweet Days of Discipline by Fleur Yeagy, which is really amazing.
Okay. Yeah.
Also set in a boarding school.
Okay.
Sweet Days of Discipline.
Were you into the sort of... I'm told there is a genre of, like, boarding school...
There's a genre for everything, isn't there?
Yeah, and are you into that genre? Was that something you referenced?
It wouldn't be something that I would seek out, but I think when I was writing the book, of course, I wanted to do my due diligence. Also, there's lots of books that I love, like The Sweet Days of Discipline. I'm a huge fan of Fleur Yeagy's work. And Violette Le Duc's Thérèse and Isabelle and La Bâtarde as well. Obviously, there's lots of horny lesbian... boarding school scenes and that too. And also, again, that I think especially there's no sex in Sweet Days of Discipline, but there is in La Bâtarde, and that Le Duc does something very similar with the mimicry and the language of sex, meaning more than the sex itself, and how you're able to reflect how the work that language can do, which is always a surprise to me when it comes to sex, I think, because most of the time language feels like something you're bumping up against, but actually in sex writing sometimes it can feel... like a real possibility.
I want to talk more about that and specifically the way you write sex later, but I'm interested in how deep you go into... So for anyone who hasn't read it, the boarding school is kind of presided over by a character called the Dead Author who went to the school, right, and became a famous author, is kind of known but is never named. Mm-hmm. And I would love to hear more about that character and why she exists.
I think within the setting of the boarding school and also in our current moment, I wanted to try and make visible that obsession over nostalgia. And I think that was one way of doing it. And with the dead author, of course, because she's a woman, and I think that like femininity in the backdrop of the school is very important. It was able to do twice the work linguistically. And also this idea, I think like the idea that, oh God, I'm going to sound so pretentious now. Explain your own writing. It's terrible. You never do it.
But I think you just have to write that one off.
Yeah. She becomes like, I think like the idea of the feminine ideal becoming this thing that looms as well, which sounds so bad out loud. But I think that was like something that interested me too. And the girls are supposed to kind of live up to this or like aspire.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And it's also maybe something that should be moved on from.
Right, and what's interesting is that they are also, she hangs over them like, this is how you should be, or this is the figure that we are aspiring to. But then I like how your protagonist at one point actually questions whether she was, the dead author was queer as well, because she was miserable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. And I have that, the scene where she masturbates, well, the protagonist masturbates over the idea of her as well. So, spoiler alert.
Yeah. Can I just check? Can everyone at the back hear?
Yeah, okay? Sorry, am I not talking too quietly?
Good. Okay.
I feel like I'm mumbling.
So, you lean into the sort of pomp of the boarding school, and I wondered if you're interested in this sort of ridiculousness of British tradition.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's a quote, they're doing this sort of run thing. It says, this is a historic event. They pay for the history. And you tread the line very carefully between sort of mocking it and just being the characters kind of like fascinated by it as someone who's from Australia. But yeah. I'd love for you to say more about that.
I think probably that line sums it up. I think there's an interesting parallel in ideas of the surveillance between the protagonist and the way the school functions too. It's like, I think the protagonist also feels watched in how out of place they feel and where they are as well. And I think the school, the architecture of it is supposed to be a bit of a leaning on that too. And it was important to me to represent the sameness of those sorts of institutions so that they aim for a kind of sameness and they produce a sameness. Mm. I think that's why maybe I wanted the boarding school to feel like a generic environment. So if you've recognised it within British culture or if you've been to one, then it was able to be almost interchangeable, I guess. Yeah,
this focus on conformity. I remember at the girls' school I went to, it was like a convent school. Everyone had to have the same, exact same length skirt.
Yeah.
And it was, and you know, they're just like factories for gay people. I don't know.
Yeah, they are. That's like what happens, isn't it? I know, like you oppress and repress all you want, but it's.
But also, they're quite.
Factories for gay people.
Your school. Yours. Yeah, it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
It's having that opposite effect. But the school that you paint a picture of, the girls are, they're a little bit mean, but they're not actually as mean as I remember girls at school.
No, I didn't want to take that too, it was important.
Just felt too easy?
Yeah, too easy. And I think also it's not, that would do a disservice to what's happening in those spaces as well. If you're able to place too much blame on the girls themselves, that seems to be the problem in and of itself that we live through anyway, is that there's a lot of. Yeah, so I wanted them to feel more like a Greek chorus than something to be judged, which is why I think having them as the girls was not supposed to be cruel. It was supposed to be not a get-out clause, but a way of seeing them as something that's being landscaped, not something that's able to have individuality, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Just to talk about the form of the book, so anyone who hasn't read it yet, again, there's not kind of clearly delineated speech and speech marks. So the speech flows within the prose and is not always attributed, which I actually found really easy to.
I'm glad that you found it.
Yeah, because a lot of the reviews are sort of saying, like, at moment, some, I did, at the odd moment, I was unsure of who was saying what. Mm. I didn't really find that.
That's a relief for me to say, thank you.
Yeah, okay, good. But I wondered if you could just speak to that choice a little further.
Do you know, I think with the actual style of the book, not a lot of it was conscious decision-making. And then after the fact, I think I wrote one chapter very, actually the swimming chapter was the first chapter that I wrote. I wrote that very furiously and then looked back to see what I'd done. And that's what I'd done. And I think in the end, I had to kind of back myself on that style because it was what was happening anyway. There's no like myth of the intellectual genius here. It's just like, oh yeah, that worked. Let's keep doing it. And I think it's funny when a book comes out because then you have to stand by these decisions that you didn't realise you were making. And I do stand by that decision because I think you want to be able to float in and around and outside of the protagonist's mind, because that's the experience of the protagonist, is this kind of watchfulness, being watched and also being lost in all that, and trying to think through that in real time. Because I chose this very difficult, the tense is like impossible, and I'd never do it again because it's so first person, very immediate present tense. And it does mean there's not a lot of room for anything outside of the body, I think, is what I was aiming for. So everything's being processed, experienced in a very physical way, including language. Mm-hmm. Sounding pretentious again. But that is what I was aiming for. And so now that it's being brought up a lot, it's good to know that I can stand by it, I guess, having accidentally decided to do it.
It is very immediate in terms of the body at all times. And I think that adds to the sense of feeling the protagonist feeling so conscious of their body in that space, especially being called Miss the whole time, which I don't know if anyone's had the experience of, like, if I'm in a shop and someone says Madam, I just drop into my body instantly. And I know people feel that to different extents.
I think that feeling of being dropped into your body outside of your own control is something that was important to me. Again, a very familiar feeling for me as well. So
yeah. But I was just reading the piece in the current issue of the LRB about Mrs. S, and Josie Mitchell, the writer, talks about your decision not to sort of delineate who's saying what or attribute speech, and says it's a kind of mirroring between Mrs. S and the matron. So at times you don't know whether Mrs. S is saying something or the matron saying something, or you maybe have to go back and check. And then I was like, this is incredible, because this is the linguistic articulation of the lesbian urge to merge, which is like...
mimicry, baby.
Yeah, it's so good. Was that an intention for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think especially, again, like going back to sex writing and not just the act itself, but the language that leads into that, it felt important to have this slippage between the two characters because there is like a lot of reflecting that happens. And I think the protagonist there's like plenty of times where they're wanting to be some kind of ideal for Mrs. S, which is also a very familiar lesbian feeling, I guess, which is kind of half what I mean by mimicry. I think for a sense of reality, which isn't necessarily what I'm most interested in, but I think in and around intimacy and sex, that idea of the speed and the rhythm of it means those two things, the self can get kind of merged by urge, you know.
Yeah. But also, whatever type of romance it is, what you just said about wanting to be the ideal, I think you convey that so beautifully. And also, turning someone else into an ideal, there's a part where you say, I'm going to butcher this. I invent her when she's there, and I invent her when she's not there, and I invent her when she's there, or something like that. You can probably correct.
I don't know off by heart. That sounds about right, though. I think, when she's not around, I invent her. Something along those lines. This idea that the protagonist is also a co-conspirator in that idea of an ideal. So it's still also done, towards the end of the book, that felt important, that it wasn't, there's no hard done by...
No spoilers.
Eh? No spoilers.
Just checking.
I think that... I can't remember what I was saying.
Sorry.
I'm going to spoil it. What was I going to say? I'm sure it's going to be out.
By the end of the book. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I was scared there was a by the end. I invent her... Oh, the character...
Yeah, when she's not... So this idea that the protagonist has also consciously participated in that idea of how you turn somebody into an ideal. Because it suits... Mm. It can suit sex. It can suit, like, the height of passion, doing that too. Height of passion. God. Where am I getting these phrases from?
You've come from a background of writing poetry, and this is your first novel. Mm-hmm. You weren't super happy that someone described the book as a long prose poem.
Only because it sounded like a burn when it was being said.
Yeah. Firstly, why is that annoying? And secondly, how did your work as a poet inform the writing of this? I mean, I could say what I think, which is just simply being able to do so much with a little. Like, your sentences are super short and super clean, and they just give so much, but I'm sure you have different answer.
It definitely isn't annoying. It's not annoying for it to be described as a long prose poem. I think only because it wasn't my... Because I am so interested in prose poetry and I write that as well, the two experiences of execution feel very different. Mm. I think with prose poetry, there's like a level of language that... It's like hyper condensed, even more condensed than how I wrote Mrs. S. And it's also, I don't think that I could sustain a whole novel if I was writing a long prose poem, because it's even more breathless in a way. Like, what interests me in language, especially in poetry, is rhythm. And I think that's the one thing that gets carried across into my prose writing, is that idea of, like, I'm not just interested in the line, but maybe the paragraph, maybe the chapter. The chapters are all really short, but that's because there's, like, a pace that I can't, like, maintain beyond, like, a few thousand words, I suppose. And in that way, it feels very familiar to me in writing poetry, because for me that's also about rhythm. Like, rhythm comes first, I guess. Thus the short sentences that are also driving people a bit bonkers, I think. But, yeah.
I love them.
Good. Good.
That, again, like, a little, like, they're sparse and it's Spartan, but it, there's so much there. And also, it kind of adds to the sexiness, because there's something withholding, a little bit withholding about, almost about the sentences themselves.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, give me a bit more. And it kind of sort of, yeah, it kind of reflects the feeling the protagonist has towards Mrs. S.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was intentional, but.
Yeah, I think I had to find a style that would be able to cope with the sex writing and not have your fear, which is, like, getting a bad sex award. Like, it's terrifying writing sex. Like, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, it's a millimetre between good and bad sometimes. And
yeah.
It felt like with this, that I had to rehearse it.
How do you rehearse writing sex? You had to rehearse the sex by having the sex.
I rehearsed the writing.
Okay.
But I'm really glad that's how that came across.
It sounds like you had the sex and then you wrote it down.
Yeah, that's a good one to remember going forward. No, I practiced sex writing by... I wrote out a couple of scenes that didn't make it into the book, that didn't work, and then you adjust and go back. I also copied out a lot of passages from people who write sex really well. That's always my biggest tip.
Copied out passages?
Like, find somebody who writes sex in a way that you respond to and then copy it out. And I think that's, again, goes back to rhythm. You can find the rhythm in somebody else's work and not imitate it, but... you can, like, see what... you can understand while you're writing out. It has to be, for me anyway, by hand, how they're breaking it down as well.
That's a good tip. I'm going to do that. Yeah. And who... I was actually going to ask you who some of those people are. I mean, I think there's been one or two... well, I think I saw a comparison to Garth Greenwell somewhere.
Yeah, I did a lot of cleanness because I think that his sex writing is so precise and does that interiority so well, without breaking pace in the sex itself. Like, the movement between the physical and the emotional is so precise, and again very rhythmic. Also, I read a lot of Marjorie Kemp by Robert Bloch. I think the sex writing in that is so extraordinary because it leaves so much room for a self-reflection, similar to Garth Greenwell. I think that's what interests me most. I think, like I said, with language, it can be largely frustrating to work with text, but when it comes to sex, it gets more interesting, I think, because you're actually able to add something different, or you're able to slow it down in a way that becomes interesting, and language actually functions for once in a way that adds something to reality, I think. Anyway,
I actually did a writing sex class with Garth Greenwell, because he is the master, in my opinion,
and
it was cool. We read a bunch of stuff that he thought did sex really well, and one of the texts was from The Price of Salt.
Oh, yeah, well, also the master.
And a mixture of things. The book Luster, yep. I think, was in there.
Raven Leilani, also amazing.
Giovanni's Room was in there.
Yeah, also amazing. I mean, you can't get away without having... kind of shame and humiliation is such an important component in queer sex as well.
Yeah.
I think all sex, but queer sex especially, it's something that you have to also move through in a way where it doesn't become tethered to it, but it is acknowledged, you know?
Well, we should talk about shame and humiliation in the book, because it's kind of there almost throughout. The girls humiliate the matron character a little bit. The drama teacher humiliates the matron character a little bit. And I guess we should explain in what kind of ways, just for anyone who hasn't read it, if you want to...
How the matron's kind of undone by them.
Yeah, where the sort of shame and humiliation comes from.
I think I wanted it to be, it felt important that it was not subtle, but it was every day, I suppose. So the matron's working in this all-girl school, and the girls, obviously, at that age, are grappling with their own sexuality, as yet unexpressed and also overly expressed, I guess, which is also a familiar feeling that I have from being a teenager. Like, I didn't want to lose that either in the book. And there's, like, a decent amount of homophobia, and... because I'm interested in language, I guess, I also wanted to turn around a few words like dyke, like lesbian, and how they come out of different mouths, I suppose. Yeah. And the girls use those that language in a way to kind of punish the matron and also to make... I think there's like a slight... There's a degree, of course, of not knowing the weight of what you're holding with those words too, I think, that I wanted to show in the girls too. But yeah, but they're kind of low-key bullies, I guess.
Well, that kind of casual homophobia that's thrown around at school comes across. Mm. And it is homophobic, there's no denying that. But then also the way that the character feels about themselves or how uncomfortable they feel in that environment generally sort of then heightens. It's like they are being homophobic, but that character feels so different in that space that it even heightens the effects of it. You can't help thinking that if they were in a different environment.
I think there's also one of the earlier scenes that I wrote for everyone that hasn't read the book is a scene in which the girls are rehearsing a play. And it's a play that's probably slightly beyond them in terms of context. It's a Lorca play called The House of Bernarda Alba, and it has these five daughters that are very oppressed by a kind of matriarchal mother figure. And it has like a pretty disturbing ending, and these 13-year-old, 14-year-olds are being asked to act it out, and that felt familiar to me as well at school, this idea of being held back in so many ways but then pushed into these very adult arenas in other ways. And the matron's required to go and watch this rehearsal because she has to take them back afterwards. And while the matron is there, they ask... I mean, I use they, them pronouns and she, her for the protagonist, so I'll switch between the two, but they are asked to stand in for the one male character in the whole play. And it becomes a scene of, like, very... I hope it comes across in, like, a very... it's a really complicated humiliation because, of course, no one knows yet what they're requiring of this character to do, to stand there and pretend to be a man and get the posture right, and they're kind of physically adjusting the protagonist's body in that scene. And I think that scene, for me, really sums up how humiliation functions in the book, because it's happening twice, and that the matron, in not being sure of or having this quite a big sense of who they are but maybe not a willingness to express it just yet, or maybe an inability to find the right way to express it, knows what's happening but everyone around them doesn't know what's happening. So that's humiliating again, in the knowledge that they also don't know what they're doing to the protagonist. I think that's it, that dual function of it was important to me in the book as well. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
That I rambled, but
no, that makes sense.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You don't really specify in the book what the time period is, but I guess if one does the maths, there are a few clues, and if you kind of were to guess, you would guess 90s.
Yeah, I think around the 90s.
Yeah.
Again, like I, not that it was on purpose, but I didn't want to get too caught up in external detail in that way. So in my mind, it's like loosely 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
But some people have said 80s, and I think that would also make sense to the book's logic as well. So,
but you can feel that it's a different time to now in terms of how the sexuality or the identity of the protagonist is kind of received and it allows it to be so in the body and through looks and through subtlety and through reading rather than through labels and language, which I think we're a bit more concerned about now.
Yeah, I would agree. I think for that laser focus... it had to be a very narrow passage through which we're seeing everything and quite like a compressed environment. And that way I didn't want there to be any external pressure or external... I mean, because I wanted the politics of the school to be the main and only functioning of politics that happens in the book, which I realise is like a complicated thing to do with queerness, but it also allows you to be in the body in a different way.
Yeah.
And to allow the body to take up more space, I think, too.
Yeah. And I think that the... sort of the shame and the humiliation in a strange way feeds into the sexual relationship with Mrs. S. Like, their sex itself doesn't feel very It's like kink. It's a bit kink. Kind of. It's hot.
Kinky to suck. It depends where you're at.
Yeah. But. Depends who you are. What do you think kinky is?
Yeah, exactly.
But then there's the surrounding context and the sort of secrecy and shame and humiliation and sort of other. There's something, there's a kind of salvation in their sex because this outside of it, that person feels quite unaccepted in that space or quite othered in that space. Mm-hmm. And then they feel so accepted through the sex. But then it still seems to lend a kind of S&M vibe to the sex, I felt.
Yeah. Yeah, what was I trying to do with... I think that I wanted there to be a decent asserting of self and of personhood in the sex for it to work. Mm. So I didn't want... I also, for the power dynamic too, that felt important for there to be like a... There isn't necessarily an equality of power between them, but there is like an understanding of each other's positions. Mm. And so that felt really important to get right. And in order to have that get right, you needed people who knew what they wanted and also were willing to assume what the other person wants. Again, going back to that idea of mimicry and how we become each other in desire and when we're desired and desiring. That kind of interchangeability between the desired object interested me because there aren't a lot of spaces in which that can happen. Because I had this compressed environment, it allowed that to be a bit more visible, that they both kind of swap places in that physically and emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah. We're kind of almost coming to the end, so please do prepare questions for Kay, but just to talk a bit about what you said, that the school provides this almost microcosmic environment for the politics, really, and that is so, it's a closed environment. One thing I found interesting, though, is when the character calls home and says about their mum, I found this like a thing I'd never thought of before when it came to coming out or queer identity, and it says, you write, the confession of my gayness left her permanently patronized, overly exposed. I introduced a subject she knew nothing about, forced her into an ignorance she found frightening. And that's actually the character speaking to their mum on the phone, remembering coming out to their mum, but it could just as easily be about Mrs. S. Which is kind of...
Interesting.
But I never thought of someone of that dynamic in terms of coming out.
Which part of it hadn't you thought of before?
I hadn't thought of making someone feel ignorant.
Yeah, I...
I know it sounds obvious, but I kind of just hadn't... Although maybe I have, because sometimes I'll be talking about gay stuff and a family member will be like, remember, we don't know what you're talking about. or why do we make gay people sound more interesting than straight people? I've been accused of it.
Wow.
So it kind of reminded me of that, but I hadn't really thought of it or I hadn't really seen it written down like that before.
For me, it was interesting from a point of probably a combination of empathy and also what you're talking about. I think I needed the protagonist to be self-aware, so it felt important that they were able to reflect on that relationship as well. Mm. I hadn't thought about it in relation to Mrs. S, but I guess it also makes perfect sense. Yeah. I think back in the day, I slept with a lot of straight cis women, so maybe that's like where that empathy is coming
Not
from as well.
Not that surprised to hear that, having read the book.
But I think I'm sure we all did before, like pre-app, you know, like it happened, and whether or not it's not something, it doesn't have to be like an identity that lasted for those people. But I think that idea of ignorance probably came from that, just the sense that you can also leave somebody else in the dark, I guess. For the mother, I think it becomes like a integral cog in their relationship because it's a way for the protagonist to also forgive their own mother, which is harsh. You know, you have to find these ways to work through it with people when they aren't going to come to a proper moment of understanding. So you have to find, again, language for how they're misunderstanding, I suppose. Mm. So that was one way.
And you find such beautiful language for understanding. The character in the book of the housemistress, who is a kind of older queer character who's also not really out at the boarding school, and they form a friendship, and it is so beautiful. And there is a scene, I think I can say this like without spoil, there's a scene where the housemistress gives the matron, the protagonist, a chain, like a lesbian.
It's just, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's almost like another romance. It's beautiful.
That was one of the most unexpected parts of the book. I think that definitely wasn't... Not that I never really write with very much of a plan. Everything kind of evolves as I'm going. But the housemistress was like, I've been thinking a lot about this idea of fantasy and how that functions for queer people, because of course for such a long time you're living in fantasy more than you're living in the real world, like before coming out or even once you've come out, and then you're not quite sure what to do with yourself. And in my fantasy from when I was probably the same age as the girls at school, there was ideas of like mentors and this person that I would meet that would kind of show me the way. And for me, it was an English teacher that I'd have an affair with, but I chose a headmaster's wife because why not go to the next level? but I haven't kind of fully formed my thoughts on it, but I think the whole book comes from this like very soft place of queer fantasy where I like kind of work through these characters that maybe I might have invented and they've been in the back of my mind when I was like 14. And of course, everyone had like gay PE teachers at school that you weren't allowed to like fully relate to, because otherwise you get called a lesbian and they're called a lesbian. It's a whole like 12-year-old mess.
Yeah.
So I think it's also like I'm paying tribute to that person too, because I had a few. I had one very great, definitely gay PE teacher while I was at school as well, who obviously wasn't allowed to be out, and it probably was kind of a rough time for them. They got pseudo-bullied by the girls. So the housemistress is a real tender one for me. Mm. And a really nice one to write too. I feel like I really knew that person. I hope, because in part, like, you end up becoming that person through fantasy as well. Like, I think fantasy also...
You grow into that person.
Exactly. Yeah. Fantasy also paves the way for this kind of, like, you can externalise all those qualities as well.
Yeah, you kind of become the mentee, the mentor.
Yeah.
We can't spoil the ending, but I am curious, and I'm sure people who have read to the end might also be curious, did you know what the ending was when you began writing?
No.
That's the only thing I can ask without going too close to what the ending actually is.
No, the ending... Well, now you're giving me the hard task trying to ask the question.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Thanks, mate. The ending, like I said in the beginning, the idea for writing the novel was to write a happy ending, because we get so bullied out of them as queers. And I think the ending is still happy. I do think the ending is still happy. I think what I was trying to do was fit quite a... to use the overused word, heteronormative framework onto a book that then wouldn't really lend itself to being within that kind of plot. So the idea of, like, you know, having an ending that feels satisfying, I had to kind of reevaluate what a satisfying ending meant in the romance genre. We're going back to genre. And if you look at romance, it's largely heterosexual, of course, largely cis. And the ending is always, like, the white pony in the sunset and, you know... disappearing into it together. And I did try it out and I was like, this feels off. And so I had to go back and kind of rehearse the ending as well. It took a little bit of work to get around what happiness would actually mean in that scenario. You know, I had to rethink it.
Before we go to questions, two quick things. So who would play Mrs. S in a film?
You go first. We talked about this.
Talked about it on the phone, and I think Rachel Wise would be... No, but then we decided that she's already been claimed now as, like, a queer.
She's done it. She's done so much snogging.
And then Claire... Yeah, she's already done it.
She's done so many snogs.
Then Claire from the shop, Klaus, said Kate Winslet.
I mean, that would be a hot choice.
That would be really good.
I think Gillian Anderson deserves a shot because hasn't done enough snogs. I personally love it.
Yeah, true. Okay. Does anyone want to suggest anyone?
Twenzy's read it, but... Yeah. Nicole Kidman. Oh.
Yeah, quite...
Interesting.
I see it, actually.
I can see it.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
Anyone else want to suggest anyone? Naomi Watts.
Again, I like all these people with excellent posture.
Yeah, it's interesting. Is she
perfect.
Is she blonde or brunette? She's brunette, right? No, we don't know.
I think I ever mentioned the hair colour once in the whole book, do I?
Maybe you don't, actually.
No.
Someone was paying
attention.
There's
not a lot of, like, physical descriptors in the book, actually, so it could be that leaves it wide open.
Yeah.
But posture feels very important, so I'm really happy with those.
And before we go to questions, what are you working on at the moment? You're working on another book?
Working on the second novel and also finishing the poetry manuscript. Those two small things.
And very busy talking about this set.
Yes. But yeah, poetry and the second novel, both.
With the second novel's not the sequel?
Sadly, no. I mean, could be read as, I suppose.
Okay.
Why not?
That's the most you can say?
That's the most I can say for now because I haven't finished
it. We haven't written it yet.
Yeah.
All right. Does anyone want to ask any questions to Kay?
You already asked the most important question.
Thanks, Bobby.
you've talked about the way that you wrote everything in this like really immediate present tense.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask how you balance that kind of like almost myopic writing with fantasy and with a kind of like almost like a lack of future occasionally without making it...
Say lack of future?
Yeah, like a kind of like without making it super depressing. Because I didn't find it super depressing.
Super depressing. Yeah.
You know, no future is depressing.
How do I balance it? Well, firstly, I'm glad that I do. No, I'm like, that's a relief. I don't know. I think not overdoing things like the... Not overdoing, that's the wrong word. I think keeping a really fine balance of things like we were discussing, like the shame, the humiliation, the homophobia, and keeping that in check with also the character's pleasure. I think it's kind of like a balance between those two things, which also, I guess, is like a very queer thing to have to maintain. Because I was aware of it, and I didn't want it to feel depressing, so I'm glad that it doesn't. But I also didn't want it to feel lacquered, you know, lacquered over. I didn't want it to feel varnished. I want it to feel not real. God, that's like the worst word ever. I wanted it to feel like it hovered somewhere in between all of those things, I guess. And I'm glad that I found the balance. I think that's probably one of the things that I was most worried about. Yeah, I think that's probably my answer. Making sure there was enough pleasure alongside the humiliation. Also making sure those things were allowed to overlap in a way that felt true to the protagonists themselves, I guess. It's kind of a roundabout answer. I'll have to think of a better one.
Any more questions, Marianne? We've got one down here.
Hi. So you talked a lot about writing sex, but it would be interesting to hear you talk about how you wrote the seduction aspect and how you just thought about the two characters, I guess becoming more and more intimate and what that was, that writing process is like and what was important to you.
I had to kind of think about it like I obviously haven't written a novel before. So I did study, I read a lot of books like Giovanni's Room. I read like how scenes function, which sounds like a very obvious thing to say. But it's one of the hardest things about writing, right, is like how to build rather than like drop or like lose focus. And in the end, I think I wrote a list. I would write a list of like ideas for scenes, like in kind of 3 or 4 words. And then I would go through those and see which ones felt the strongest. And I ended up not having, with this book, I didn't write enough. I had to write more in the editing process. So I think sometimes I can shave too much off with the seduction especially, we had to work on that. So I think I did like, no, we didn't. It was the opposite. I did too much seducing, and then I had to. Kitty's in here somewhere looking at me. I had to shave off the seduction because that was a part that felt the most familiar to me. I think was figuring out whether you can have what you want or if it's just something that will stay in your mind. So I think at that, because it was so familiar, I overwrote that quite heavily, and then had to decide in which scenes it felt like it was working the strongest. Yeah, I hope that kind of semi answers the question ish.
It does feel that it comes at just the right time.
Well,
very good. You know, like the longing is dragged out just the right amount of time. Where you're like, and then, you know, it doesn't take too long, but it doesn't come too soon.
Well, that's great.
I would say. But I'm no expert.
Well, I mean, mate, neither am I. But I think that was a really difficult aspect of the book as well, was to make sure that it wasn't dragging on too long.
Yeah.
As gays can sometimes, so.
Sometimes the longing can just...
Keep on longing.
Keep on longing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't stop. Won't stop.
Don't stop. Won't stop. Any other questions for Kay? Hey, thank you.
I was going to ask you if there's a reason the protagonist is Australian, which obviously...
Asking for a friend.
I really want to say is it important that they're not English and I guess not part of that class system?
Yeah, that's right on the money. I think it had to be somebody who felt like an outsider to that environment in order for the environment to be filtered in the way that I needed it to be, like to be experienced in the way that, like, you know, experienced for the first time, I suppose. I think also that, like, I think at some point in the 90s, there was this overselling of a visa for Australian, like, really young Australians, like, between 18 and 20 to come over and work in these, like, kind of horrendous boarding schools as with really strange titles like Matron, and it, like, I think I was able to borrow from that and then set up what worked for me as an author. Yeah, so exactly right.
Yeah. Can I add an add-on question to that, which I didn't ask you but wanted to, which is the protagonist is not given a name.
Mm-hmm.
What was... I'd love to hear a bit more about the thinking behind that.
There was a bit of thinking behind this, which is rare for me. I think I have this idea of like a trans potential, and obviously the idea of a name is like this very it can be quite a heavy thing, right? Like, it can feel inflexible. It could make the book feel inflexible too. Mm-hmm. The book had to feel like it could move in any direction. It had to feel like this mm-hmm. character was allowed to change. And, like, with the ending of the book, the namelessness felt even more important, where they might go on to then shift into, like, a different part of themselves and a different part of their life. I think, like, naming can feel very, like...
That's interesting, because it does feel that the character is maybe at that moment where they are soon going to choose another name. So why name them? Yeah, that's interesting.
And then I didn't want it to become a burden in the text either. I think when I did try it out with a name, it felt like an interruption to what was happening.
Totally.
You know, and I think... the idea of this idea of misnaming, this idea of underestimating what that means felt more important. But I didn't want to make too much of it in the way that it felt too realized, because also you can't then burden the character with also the pressure of their own name and the way they might change. Like, I wanted it to feel very in flux. I'm not, like, names to me feel like facts sometimes, and I'm really not interested in facts. Like, I think, which is also why the book isn't really set in a particular era. I think sometimes, I don't know why, far smarter people have written about this idea of, like, queerness being ephemeral rather than factual and not evidence-based, but something that's lighter, light-footed and flexible and always in flux, I think, which is what I love about being queer so much. So I wanted that to be reflected in the book too.
That is. We have time for one last question, if anyone would like to...
Just on the theme of names again, so the book is obviously called Mrs. S. So you didn't think so much about the naming of the protagonist, but with the Mrs., was there a lot of thought about her being a Mrs. and not a Ms. or a doctor or something else? Because that's giving a very clear...
I think, yes, I did want there to be some clear signalling. I think there's also a part of it that's also about old-fashioned erotica. I think this idea of, like, a Mrs. S feels a bit like a chaste letter or something. And
or a lesbian pulp.
Exactly. Which I also, like, the idea of, like, lesbian pulp fiction was interesting to me as well. I think when I was talking about fantasy before, I think this idea of, like, a Mrs. S is part of that fantasy for me, like a queer fantasy. And when I talk to lots of my queer friends... it seems to be one that's kind of shared, especially within a school environment who you sort of had massive crushes on. It wasn't 9 times out of 10 it was somebody in a position of authority who was married, because, like, that was just, like, what we were obsessed over. Because I think there's also an idea of, like, that being unobtainable in a way as well, I think, which builds into the erotic aspect of it, hopefully without becoming cliched, because it's a fine line, but
Okay, I think we're at time. Just thank you so, so much for...
Thank you so, so much.
Because this is the first time you've really talked about the book in a talk, and you're incredible.
I'm, like, sweating.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah. Thank you. The book is wonderful. I urge everyone to buy it. I absolutely loved it. And
thank
you. Read it again tomorrow, and might do. Thanks for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events... visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.